Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. It is so nice to have you back on the podcast, Nikki. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And it's equally nice to be back.
Yes, absolutely. So for the listeners, did you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
So my name's Nikki. I come from the northwest of England. I have two sons and a daughter and a husband. And my daughter has had anorexia since the age of 14 and she is now 26. So as a family and as a parent and as a mum, we have been and have supported her throughout all these years in trying to just live with the illness. We've had experiences from adolescent to adult services, outpatient community to inpatient services, different counties where she's been inpatient, experiences of being sectioned under the Mental Health Act, general hospitals, and also step-down units. So lots of different experiences over the years, so which is why I feel, there's a word empowered, I'm not quite sure, but why I think just being able to talk about what can happen within an eating disorder journey, by no means is our journey unique. But equally, there are many, many successful people who have had really good experiences. And we have at times. But out there, there are lots of people that are fully recovered or at least learning to live with and can cope with an eating disorder. And that's the stage that we hope to get to one day with my daughter. So that's us in a nutshell.
Well, thank you very much for explaining. I think it's very inspiring when, you know, people talk about their own experience and want to use that in order to help the greater good. So, you know, I'm sure it's, you know, very difficult at times for you, but being able to use that experience and then, you know, push for change, it is really inspirational to hear. So thank you so much for all the work that you do.
I think it's just useful. I think because as we're going to talk about this report that's just coming out tomorrow, you know, I was reading it the other day and I was thinking there's actually so much of that report that we fall into in a true real life experience. So I know we're not unique. And I know there are lots of issues and lots of recommendations that, you know, eating disorder services could improve, could get better. And that's not to say that's any fault or implication of the people that work in it. It's just they need more help. They need more funding. They need more research. It's an area where illnesses that are growing, it's a very much a growth illness area. And yet the funding, research, knowledge, et cetera, just isn't there. So I think anyone that can talk with experience, I don't do this with a woe is me attitude and oh, listen to what we've had to suffer, because that's really not what it's all about. It's just backing up where the evidence that's done through research and speaking to people, I can talk to and relate to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the thing, isn't it? And I think that's the thing that a really key message to get home is, like, this is, you know, your experience is unique to you, yes, but actually experiencing an eating disorder is not something that is, you know, uncommon. It is actually a very common thing, way more common than, you know, the funding and the, like, research would kind of suggest. Yeah. And I was thinking about this yesterday, actually, when I was thinking about the report in terms of, like, when I do workshops or educational based stuff, you know, whether that's going into healthcare settings or whether that is going into corporate environments or schools or what have you, every single person I come across always says, oh yeah, I know blah, blah, blah. They had an eating disorder, you know, whether it's my daughter, my son, you know, my family friend, that's like there's always somebody who knows somebody
who knows of somebody. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But then what when I was thinking about it yesterday, I was like, it's such a funny situation because everyone will say, oh, I know blah, blah, blah. However, I have no idea of how to talk about it.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the
real. No real idea of actually what it's like living with an eating disorder.
Yeah.
Not just from obviously the sufferer's perspective, but from the sibling's perspective, from the parent's perspective, from the friend's perspective. how to actually even begin to understand it. It's a big, big area, and just raising awareness is so crucial.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. Also a very, very individual illness, isn't it? So there is, yes. There is no one size fits all, and no one treatment fits all. And I think that's, you know, having an area where they're prepared to sort of think outside the box a little bit, is beginning to happen, rather mm-hmm. than, you know, this is the pathway, this is how it goes. But there's so much more that's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, hopefully with this report, you know, I'm very hopeful that things will start moving in the right direction. So do you want to tell us a bit about the report and how that came about?
Yeah, so the APPG is a report that's been put together predominantly by a fabulous lady called Hope Virgo, who I'm sure many people have heard of, who's a massive advocate and a campaigner for eating disorders. So Hope is working with obviously some very eminent clinicians and people in the world eating disorder world who've put together the report together. And it's basically just come in the time when it's widely recognised that eating disorders needs some intervention from the government, really. It's talked about. We've had, you know, money has been allocated to, but you never really see that. Doesn't really hit the ground, and it's all mental health rather than eating disorders. Eating disorders, you know, have been seriously neglected for years, meaning lots of people just can't access eating disorder services and treatment when they really need it. People are left to languish on waiting lists for years and years. And I say here, not everybody. Depends where you live in the country as to how quickly you can get into an eating disorder service. It depends on lots of other criteria, but there are people out there that are being told their BMIs aren't low enough and therefore they can't access treatment, or there's long waiting lists, or there are no beds available if inpatient is required. So people, you know, they can't access treatment, they're deemed too sick, or maybe they're discharged too early. There's nothing out there that sort of, there's no standard approach. So one collaborative trust will have a completely different set of rules and regulations and entry requirements than another. So it's very, very fragmented. People have been eating disorders for a long time and are struggling to recover despite they deserve compassion. You know, they deserve quality of care. And research tells us that you know, people can improve. This is a treatable illness. This is an illness that no matter how long someone has had the illness, they can recover. So the report was put together over the last few months. There's been lots of research. There's been lots of workshops, lots and lots of reading, and lots of information gathered. So it's a very, very factual, honest report that's come out that we're going to be delivering tomorrow in Parliament, a team of us, and talking about what the report's going to do. So it's taken about 6 months to put the report together. We've met with patients, families, clinicians, researchers, and shared deeply personal and harrowing accounts of their experiences of the failure of eating disorder services. And that's completely across the board. That's from children to young adults, children as young as four being diagnosed with AFRED, right the way through to obviously eating disorders, bulimia, anorexia, and the other types of eating disorders. And even we've interviewed and met with people who very, very sadly have lost their own patients, their own children as well, to this illness. So, you know, it's a complete wide report. It's covered every single angle possible from, and not just patients and carers. It's very much work. We've spoken and had workshops with clinicians, with managers, with funding commissioning agents, everybody. So it's all documented in report. And the APBG also submitted a freedom of information request to all hospital trusts asking for information, and replicated the process for data in January to October 2024. So we found, you know, finding lots and lots of data that it's not made up. It's true. You can't make up the facts, can you? Revealing numerous trusts of discharging patients at very, very low BMIs. So there is talk of a BMI in the report. There needs to be a standardised approach for BMIs and discharge. So there are areas in the country will discharge patients with low BMIs, very low BMIs. There are some that will discharge sort of on a 14, 15 BMI, but there's no standard approach. And the other thing, the report or the finding we found is that there's still the postcode lottery. You know, we've been in this journey, should I say, for 14 years. It was a postcode lottery 14 years ago, and it still very much is as to the quality of treatment and access to treatment. So the APPG, having done all this research over the last 6 months, has got some, you know, key recommendations that we're asking government to look at and consider and take on board. So one of the main ones is a national strategy. And that's basically the idea to develop a comprehensive national strategy for eating disorders for both adults and young people with adequate funding to meet the demand. So, you know, that's really important. It's a really basic fact. It's other illnesses get it. You know, it's not as if, you know, it's not as if it's a unique request, but that's very much what we're looking for. Service reform is another recommendation. Ensure that all individuals with eating disorders can access timely and evidence-based treatment. So they're not put on waiting lists. They're not having to wait, which particularly happens in adult services. They're not having to wait a long time. They're not being told their BMI isn't low enough, or in fact, their BMI is too high, basically, you know, for treatment. We're also asking for a confidential inquiry. So that's to establish a confidential inquiry into eating disorder related deaths, because these are happening and there's no denying it. There's some very harrowing stories of, you know, people dying, young people, adolescents through to, you know, 20s, 30s. My daughter, very, very sadly, someone she's been impatient with for a long time, died only last week, leaving two young children behind and dying from an eating disorder. And that in itself is a tragedy. These are, with knowledge, care, compassion, and the right care and compassion and understanding, these are treatable illnesses. And we hear fantastic stories of people that have had an illness 20, 25, 30 years, and then they're able, because they have had access to proper treatment, people haven't given up with them. So to hear of deaths is just immensely sad. And then the other recommendation we're asking for is research investments. So to allocate some funding to research into eating disorders to improve prevention, to improve diagnosis, and to improve treatment outcomes. You know, every illness, everyone is entitled to research, and there is research going on in eating disorders, but not enough. And it takes forever. So yeah. To put together a research project, to put together the proposal, to then gather the respondents, et cetera, takes forever. And the biggest challenge is getting funding in the first place. So, you know, those are the key recommendations that the APPG have come out of the report. That's in a nutshell, I think, what the APPG is about.
Yeah, no, I think it's really helpful to understand kind of, you know, the key things that have come out of it, and I guess the motivations as well for why those recommendations have been made. And I think, you know, we hear so much, don't we, about the postcode lottery. And like last week, for example, it's not specific to eating disorders, but I was at the Royal College of Psychiatry conference and someone was speaking about the lived experience role that they have, and that they are actually teaching medical students about eating disorders. And I was like, this is absolutely fantastic, but this shouldn't be specific to a trust or a university. This should be countrywide, that all trusts should be engaging students to teach them about, you know, the whole array of mental health conditions. But we particularly know that eating disorders, you know, massively fall under the radar.
You know, Hannah, that's really interesting. So I work and teach at a university, and we have a huge faculty, which is a health department, and they have several nursing courses, from mental health nursing courses to general nursing to adult nursing to child nursing, lots and lots of different courses, 3-year courses. They also have social worker courses. They also have a psychology course, et cetera, et cetera. So I sort of got involved about 2 years ago asking where in your curriculum do you cover eating disorders? And with the exception of the mental health course, 3-year course, none of them included it as a core unit or anything. Most of them at best had an hour or an hour and a half's lecture in the whole of 3 years. Social workers had absolutely nothing. And you think, well, why would social workers need to know about eating disorders? Of course they do. They're the ones that come along and help section, you know, and they're the ones in some trusts that are in charge of commissioning and forward care and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I now go in, and luckily I've got some guest lecture slots, and all of our courses now get a 2-3 hour lecture. But still, within 3 years, that's not very long. And you know, they are nurses. Most of them are really receptive. Some of them have chosen to do eating disorders or mental health anyway, and have had placements, so they have a little knowledge. But I think that stems out even more when my daughter was in a general hospital. She was on a gastro ward, and the nurses there absolutely just couldn't cope. It got them terribly upset because A, they'd had no training. They didn't know what to say. And one of the lasting comments came from one of the nurses who just said, you know, we're used to sending people off the ward when they're better, when they've come to us not so well, and they're better when they're leaving, and this isn't going to happen. Yeah. And it's very distressful because they have no understanding, and it's very sad.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've spoken about this on the podcast before, and I may have mentioned it to you, but my master's thesis that I did was to develop a paediatric nurse skills-based workshop so that nurses on a general ward had an understanding of how to support someone with an eating disorder. And they said exactly the same thing. You know, normally when someone comes into hospital, you know, we diagnose them, we, you know, give them their treatment, we see them get better. But working with someone with an eating disorder, especially if it's somebody that's come in and they're an inpatient, the period of time when they're in hospital, you know, that's a very distressing time for the patient. You're asking them to do something that is literally their biggest fear, and you may not see them get to a place of recovery. You know, you can hope that once they're discharged, they then go to outpatient and they, you know, move on with their recovery in that way. But it's really difficult. And I think without that understanding and, you know, awareness of eating disorders, simple things like, you know, if you're in hospital and you don't have your lunch, it's probably not going to matter because maybe you're in hospital for a couple of days. But for an eating disorder patient that's in hospital, you know, that is crucial. And so I think it goes back to the point that you said earlier, in that there's nobody that's working, you know, in these trusts or in these hospitals that doesn't care. The thing is that they care so much, and they want to understand so much, but the resources just aren't in place for people to be able to learn.
Yeah. I think that reminds me, when my daughter, 10 years ago now, she was very young, she was put into a paediatric ward. And sometimes in eating disorders, you know, the physical side of the illness, you do need to go into a general hospital. Yeah. You know, it's not always, then you're not just put there because there isn't a bed in a SEDU or anything, but that is happening absolutely now. You know, I can't remember the statistic. It's something like it's 400 and something other eating disorder beds in the whole of this country. And more than half of those are run in the private sector. And there's over 2,000 something or other needing hospitalisation. So, but I remember being put, my daughter on a paediatric ward, and this orderly putting this like stale jacket potato in front of her with some baked beans that had clearly been on the plate and reheated 6 times. And literally folding her arms at the end of the bed and tapping her feet and saying, "Now, come on, you stupid little girl, you just need to eat. You're being selfish. Think about everything. Think about everything and everyone that you're upsetting." And she wouldn't go. This orderly wouldn't go. And I just kept saying, you know, "I think perhaps you just better leave." And she wouldn't. She said, "No, I'm not leaving until this child of yours puts something in her mouth." You know, and that is pure lack of training, because it might be that for another child that's in the hospital with a broken leg will suddenly decide she doesn't want to eat that jacket potato, they could accept that sort of strictness and that. And this orderly obviously thought that she was doing it in her own, you know, in her mind. But how bad is that?
Yeah. I mean, I would argue for irrespective of whether you've got an eating disorder or not, that sort of speaking to somebody not acceptable in the slightest. But I think, you know, particularly
highlights, isn't it, that that goes back to the existence of MEED, doesn't it, the medical emergency document, and the fact that it's widely used now in the world of eating disorders, but still within the NHS system, in accident and emergency, or the emergency department we now call it, main general hospitals, there's no knowledge, no understanding. And that is that's
something that I think, you know, the report was very passionate about speaking about, was the fact that, you know, this is not kind of like a negative towards people working within the hospitals. And I think, you know, we have already said that you can only go with the best knowledge that you have. And if you have never experienced somebody with an eating disorder, I mean, you know, for me, even when I was receiving my eating disorder treatment, I was in a specific eating disorder unit, or you're not unit, but so it was outpatient. But still, when I had the treatment, you know, I got diagnosed with atypical anorexia, which already I wasn't taken seriously because of that. And I remember we were renovating our house and my mum was like, just would like some ideas for meals, because, you know, she's really struggling with meals and like she won't eat an apple and this stuff. So it's quite difficult. And the woman was like, well, why don't you just order a pizza? And this was like an eating disorder therapist. And my mum was just sat there like, sorry, did you just hear what I said? But it's, again, it's, I mean, in that situation, maybe there was a bit of kind of, you know, not thinking about what you're saying. But if people haven't got the right training because the resources aren't put in place,
yeah,
it does make such a big difference. But I do, I think part of me does think there's also that element of stigma and stereotype and stuff, you know, in the wider context as well, that then even with training maybe makes it slightly difficult as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very hard area. It's a hard area to work in. It's a hard work area to get the message out to people. Most people have heard, as you say, of eating disorders, and of that most people have heard of anorexia, I guess, bulimia. But it's just so, yeah, I don't know what the word is really. It's just so under-knowledged about. That doesn't make sense, does it? Under-knowledged, I don't know. But there is, and you say there is stigma. I mean, even now we have friends who have been really, really supportive, but I get comments like, well, just put you on a plane, take you and sit on a beach in the middle of, you know, just go somewhere hot and sit on the beach. Or the classic one I often get is, oh, well, have you heard of this eating disorder unit? Because they've got they cured a friend of mine's daughter or a cousin of a cousin of a cousin who had a brilliant time there. And you think, yeah, every eating disorder unit does have a success story. Of course they do. You know, there's an awful lot of time and effort and some brilliant people working in them. And there are success stories, but then there's an awful lot that come back over and over again and have readmissions. And, you know, and that's the difference. The success stories are lovely and you live on those, don't you? You continue with that hope. But the statistics of, as I say, revolving doors or getting to a level and actually there's nothing more we can do is needs to be changed.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that was one of the other points that, you know, has been quite key to the report as well, in that, you know, if somebody is in that position, you know, I don't like the term revolving door patient, but no. I think people kind of understand what you mean when you say it. You know, they aren't, you know, let's say I'm big, quote unquote marks here, putting the effort in to get better. And, you know, this is kind of all the things that you hear what people say, like, you know, why should they have a bed? Because they're not trying, they're not committed to recovery and stuff like that. You know, one of the questions is, well, what is the issue with discharging them? Because at the end of the day, you know, they need to be able to help themselves. I just wonder what your thoughts were around that.
Do you know, half of you can actually think, well, actually you can understand where those thoughts are coming from. You know, I have heard and I do know of a consultant that's in a dilemma as we speak. They have lots of young people or people coming through, adult and adolescent, who are just starting on the journey, who have just been diagnosed. So do they push the resource money, what funding they have got, in supporting, you know, three or four maybe that they could support with that pot? Or do they keep that pot going for someone who's had an eating disorder for many, many years? So you can understand the dilemma that they have. I think the saddest thing that comes out of it, and again, it's highlighted in the report, is that, you know, there's huge evidence that this is a mental illness. This isn't an illness that anyone can choose to have. It's not a physical, it's not physical, it's mental. And as such, you know, it takes time. The brain, you know, there's lots of evidence nowadays to say that actually the malnourished brain, you know, nothing's going to help to start to get you better until your brain is nourished again. It's an organ. It's a muscle. It needs food. You know, there's 500 calories a day that the brain will use just to be the brain. So if you've got someone on a very, very restrictive diet, not even feeding the brain, let alone all the other muscles in the body, and your brain shrinks. You know, I know several people who have actually had brain scans, and the side of the brain that impacts eating, et cetera, is smaller. The brain scan from someone with a normal diet and who's healthy compared to someone who has an eating disorder So that massively impacts the level of recovery. And that's what you're fighting, isn't it, the whole time? You know, you can have patients who are so, so bright, can get GCSEs, A-levels, university degrees, and yet they can't eat. Their brain, you know, the thoughts, the illness is so strong, it impacts their daily life. And that is down to the brain, and that brain needs feeding. And that's the hard trouble of it all, isn't it? That, you know, when it comes to treatment, no matter how, and you often hear people say, don't you, that, you know, no one can do this but you. But the more and more trenched you get into it, the more harder and harder it becomes. And you get into habits, and you get into just not belief, you know. I don't believe I am treatable. I don't believe that anyone can help me.
Yeah. But I think especially when there's that rhetoric around you anyway, you know, if you have the healthcare professionals around you with the idea of you're untreatable, how would you then have in your own mind, how could you keep that hope alive to be like, I am going to recover? Yeah. And, you know, as I've said, I haven't been an inpatient, but I can absolutely relate to that. You know, I was ill for 12 years and then, I was in a very, very fortunate, and I completely understand it's a very fortunate position to be able to go private. And, you know, I will always say to people, in order to recover, you have to be in a position where you, you know, are making those steps towards that. But equally, as you've said, you need to be in a position also where your brain has enough energy to actually engage in recovery. And often, you know, when people are hospitalized for that, that's not the case. And so I think that's another thing that I would be really interested in, is really looking at like the stages of recovery, what support is needed at each one. Because ultimately, when somebody first lands in treatment, the goal should be just to get them eating enough and eating regularly, not even thinking about the broader picture of recovery, because I think that can sometimes feel too far away, which is then very overwhelming. And you're like, well, I definitely don't want that. I might as well just stay here.
Yeah.
And I know that was the case for me, you know, when I first started recovery and I was like, okay, I'm actually going to do this. It was about breaking it down and being like, okay, what does today look like rather than the whole picture, which I think maybe is somewhere that, you know.
Take it back to basics, right, the way back to the beginning.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Also, though, and that's what we've found. So we've had a mixture of private and NHS, and I think it so much depends on the current team that's working with you at the moment. My daughter's lucky. She has a consultant at the moment and a team who keep telling her they're holding hope for her and are looking outside the box to different types of things that could help her. That's not always been the case. She's been stuck and stagnant and in the same for months on months, not getting any worse, not getting any better. I think also personnel change. So you can build up a relationship with a psychologist or with a nurse, and then people move on. And that has a massive, I mean, that's life, isn't it? But to someone with an eating disorder, it's just like you're just getting, it takes a long time to build up trust. It takes a long time to build up working relationships. And then that disappears. And that's happened consistently. And again, not just in our experiences, but we've heard that over and over again. And it's having the person with the eating disorders, having the resilience to be able to overcome that and say, right, okay, so this person's leaving, but I know there's other people that, and then they start again. And I think that happens particularly, I think, in the NHS, because for many reasons, like burnout, if nothing else.
I think that's such a key point, in that, you know, we completely recognize that people in the NHS care so deeply. That's why they're there. Fundamentally, we're a difficult patient group. Like, you know, let's not skirt around the edges. It is very tricky. So not only have you got that, which is a heavy kind of heavy burden to hold, but equally you're not provided the right training. So then you're like, I don't even know if I'm doing this right. And, you know, I've got a lot of friends that work in the NHS, and they've often said, you know, I do feel like I'm just winging it. And, you know, they will come to me for advice, and I'll say, well, I can only speak from my own experience, but I think fundamentally what I always say to people is like, the fact that you care so deeply is extraordinarily visible. Yeah. Yeah. And to somebody that's struggling with an eating disorder, I think that's often I found the biggest thing was I just wanted to know that people, as you said, you know, were holding
you up on you
and
cared. And it must be hard at times. I mean, I have sat in CPAs and ward rounds where anorexia has really taken over. It's almost like not a different person, but my daughter's voice changes, her attitude changes, her body language changes, and I cringe. And she nine out of ten doesn't remember when she comes down from a heightened emotional state. She does not remember, thankfully, what she said. But for someone so ill to speak to people who are trying to help them, it's very hard. It's a very, very hard job. But you just have to think that is the illness and fighting through it. And that's why you need specialist people with specialist training and specialist care to be able, for their own sanity, let alone anything else.
Yeah, literally. I will always say to my mum, you know, I'm so sorry for, because I think that's the difficult thing, isn't it? As an outsider, it's just me here. However, you know, when the anorexia or the eating disorder takes over, you do become a very different person and treat people in a way that I genuinely wouldn't imagine ever treating somebody. But if there was the understanding and the education of, you know, how much it impacts your personality, how chronic it can be living with that eating disorder constantly, maybe then there would be more understanding, you know, around that. So we've gone slightly off tangent, but I think that, you know, that is absolutely fine to do, because at the end of the day, it's an emotive topic and it is a personal one. One thing I did want to ask you about is kind of, we've touched on it a little bit in terms of, you know, BMI and things like that. I think on one side of the coin, we're saying that, you know, eating disorders the severity of them aren't determined by weight. However, we shouldn't be discharging people if they're at a low weight. So I guess some people might have a question of, like, is weight important here or not? And I just wondered what your thoughts were.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one, isn't it? I think there has to be a standard, universal minimum discharge weight, of which there isn't at the moment, which is why this is mentioned very much in the APPG. As you said, on the one hand, we're saying that the person's weight doesn't determine the severity of their eating disorder. And we know that. I mean, people can be, you know, we've talked about it on other events we've held within Dump the Scales campaign, the conferences we've had. People can have an eating disorder with a much, much higher BMI. So I think that needs to be recognised. Eating disorder services, there has to be a benchmark, and like there does in life for many other things, weight is important, of course it is, but there's many, many other factors to consider, I think, when you are thinking of discharging a patient, either from an inpatient, particularly when this BMI ratio is mentioned, or even from community services. It's a mental health problem. Eating disorders are a mental health problem. Majority of people with eating disorders, I've never really become underweight before, and weight is only the factor that should be taken into account when assessing somebody for an eating disorder, and it's more important to consider the person's thoughts, feelings and behaviours around weight and food. So, you know, I remember actually I was talking to my daughter about this because she is very, very anti-BMIs and being compared to, like, you can't get out of your wheelchair until your BMI is ABC. It's a standard thing for everybody. You can't be discharged. And I was sort of saying, well, actually, you know, BMI, you know, we need this benchmark, but actually that's not the only thing that's considered when you're discharged. It's your ability to eat a meal plan, your ability to function more, to recognise, you know, certain situations and how to cope with things. There's a lot more that's considered. So I'd hate the report. I don't think it wouldn't do anyway, but I'd hate the report to suddenly say, okay, meet this BMI, everyone gets discharged back to 1 hour in community. Is you're just going to get that, you know, again. But I do think there has to be a standardization somewhere.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's you can see both sides of the argument in that there needs to be a standardization for safety, but equally there needs to be kind of the overall, the like holistic perspective in the same respect of like, you know, when someone's diagnosed with an eating disorder, okay, you might be given X diagnosis, but actually rather than just saying X diagnosis, Y treatment, it needs to be X diagnosis. But let's look at the person on an overall, let's look at their relationships, look at their lifestyle, look at their coping mechanisms, look at the other comorbidities that they might have, and then put a treatment plan into place. And I think it's the same thing with discharge. It's okay, so yeah, maybe someone's at a certain BMI, but actually, like, you know, when we go out on an occupational health visit or something, they literally can't walk around a shop and they have no idea what to buy for them, or, you know, yes, they're at their BMI, but they can't eat a meal without being assisted with
diet. And I think there are some collaborative trusts out there that absolutely do take all of that into consideration, but equally I know there are some areas in the country that don't take into consideration. I think we've also got to remember the, you know, the basically indisputable evidence that, you know, a BMI less than 15, even noted on the Mead report, poses a, you know, a significant health risk and increased risk of death. So you're still very much on the cusp, even at 15. Eating disorder patients with very low weight respect an extremely vulnerable population. You know, it's not great. Being discharged from eating disorder services completely puts them at risk. So you've got a vulnerable person, you've got still a dangerously low BMI, and yet you are talking of discharge. And I think, again, that depends, doesn't it, where you are in the country. So you have some places in the country where you could be discharged from 24/7 care into a step down, and maybe a step down rehab placement, or a step down, you know, online weekly, day in, day out support. And then you've got other places which literally you have 24/7 support, and the next day onwards you get 1 hour, 1.5 hours community support, and that's it. So, you know, it's those sort of things that the government and eating disorder services really need to address.
And just going back to the BMI thing, I think the other important perspective, like the other important point to make, is obviously, you know, if the cutoff point or whatever is a BMI of 15 to be discharged, equally, just because somebody has a higher BMI doesn't necessarily mean that they're in, you know, a medical risk. I have, you know, people that I know that have had a higher BMI, but because their BMI was set, you know, their set point was higher to start with, they've then had heart complications and things like that. So it's really difficult. We need to move away from a set thing that, like, okay, people are only at risk at X BMI, or they're fine when they reach Y, or things like that. I think there needs to be a whole lot of re-education about that.
I think also on BMIs, we hear of, you know, services discharged because the patient is absolutely saying they don't want to get better. They don't want to get better. The inpatient unit needs the beds. They've got other people with probably a lower BMI at that stage. And they, you know, you've got someone in front of you saying, I don't want to get better. That's it. But, you know, beds are completely and utterly limited around the country. But no eating disorder patient should ever be deemed beyond help. So, and I think that's a challenge. My daughter herself will say there have been times in recent years where she just can't go on anymore. She's just absolutely exhausted, and she doesn't want to. And at that moment in time, you know, if she had a consultant and a team that absolutely didn't really understand the illness, didn't listen, and thinking, right, I've got six people here that could do with the bed, you know, they could say, right, we're going to discharge you back to just physical health with your GP. Luckily, very luckily, she has a team that will not accept that. And now she's back in a place. And it can change with the flip of a knife. You know, literally, we could go back there tomorrow. But at the moment, far, far more positive. And saying, you know, I'm so glad no one listened to me. So, you know, no one should be deemed without, you know, deemed completely untreatable. You know, and the data's there to show that recovery is possible, no matter how long. And again, what sort of quality. It depends very much on the quality of care and support they've had. You know. And I suppose for some people, the recovery is, you know, not everybody is always going to recover 100% and live that perfect life.
Doesn't exist.
It's just, you know, you need to do more than exist. You know, you want to get back to a life where you are living and you are able to cope with. And, you know, people can't do that. Patients can't do that without the proper long-term support. Anyway, I'm rambling.
And I think that's such a key point, is that it is long term. It's not an overnight thing. It's not just, you know, put your leg in a cast and it'll heal. It is something that takes a long time. Well, thank you so much, Nikki. It's been so good to speak through this with you. Where can people go if they either want to find out more about the report? Christy's...
Pardon you. Okay, so... You'll edit that bit out.
I will. I'm just going to say that again. Where can people go if they want to find out more about the report or if they want to get involved?
Okay, so the report can be found on the website, which is www.endeatingdisorders.org. So that's one area where you can actually report the do the report in full. Also, we've got a couple of hashtags, which is hashtags dunk the scales. And the other hashtag is end eating disorders. But the easiest place to find the report is to go onto the endeatingdisorders.org, and the report is up there.
Because I was blowing my nose. thank
Maybe
you so
you might
much.
Want to seal that in, because I think there's other places as well and I just can't find the actual.
Well, thank you so much, Nikki. And I'll see you in Parliament.
You will, yes, yes.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.